Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast and the third episode of our Inside the Sports Car Paddock series, brought to you by our friends at Cooper Tires and also our friends at the Justice Brothers, makers of fine additives, cleaners, and lubricants for the automotive, heavy equipment, agricultural, and industrial worlds. For our third episode, we have four fine friends of the show. I'm going to start off yet again, and hopefully it's a positive thing, hopefully y'all like this, with our man Jeff Brown, race engineer, race strategist, just big brain supreme for the Core Autosport Nissan Onroad DPI effort. And actually a couple of folks asked Jeff to reach out to his friends on Facebook and Twitter to look for things they might want to have him explain. And so he came up with two topics. The second one is really, really funny. So we're going to start off with Jeff explaining things about IMSA and their yellow flag strategies, and also when looking at the rules and not bending them, but exploiting them can lead to a rule change inspired by the person who came up with that exploitation. We'll also move right after that. We're going to head into an interview done by my Weekend Sports Cars co-host Graham Goodwin with Jan Martinborough, the Welsh gaming sensation who has become a factory Nissan sensation. He will be returning to the Japanese GT500 category. Jan's obviously been doing very well in the Japanese Super Formula, but he is now going to be getting back to fun, good fun, in Super GT. So Graham connected with him. Had a little bit of audio levels going on there, so I've done my best to fix the file that came back, but do apologize if it's a little peaky. I can't fix everything, unfortunately. Then we close with two conversations that I had, one being with Brian Herta, brand new entrant in IMSA's Michelin Pilot Challenge Series with Hyundai. So spoke with Brian about that relationship, how things are going after having a very successful 2018 in the Pirelli World Challenge Series. And then I close with the great Brian Redman. So interviewed Brian for a magazine feature, and it was on a very specific topic, but we also got into some other fun things about developing the Porsche 917, just some other background items, and figured, well, since I don't need it for the magazine, but I have the audio, we have it here to close. So starting off with our man Jeff Brown, then moving on to Jan Martinborough, then Brian Herta, and closing with Brian Redman, all brought to you by Cooper Tires and the Justice Brothers, and our pals at DailySportsCar.com, Mr. Graham Goodwin. So off we go with Episode 3 of Inside the Sports Car Paddock. Jeff Brown, this is becoming rather fun, my friend. We're now into our third week of Inside the Sports Car Paddock, and we have had quite a few people say, all right, this Jeff Brown guy, we love him. He tells us all kinds of great things. He's a good explainer. And so thank you, my friend. I mean, as I think we've told folks, you and I have these conversations all the time. They've had them for quite some time. The fact that we get to just do this on kind of sort of a weekly basis and share them with folks, it doesn't feel like work, I'll tell you that.
Exactly. It's fun, and apparently other people are interested in what we talk about, which is pretty amazing, but I think it's awesome. It's fun.
So I asked you to reach out to your friends on social media to pitch in a couple of ideas for topics that might interest them for this week. Now again, our third episode, and we got two, and I think this is going to be kind of fun, knowing that being a race-winning engineer, someone who has competed in NASCAR, IndyCar, GTs, prototypes, you name it, you have competed in so many forms of motor racing that now, with what we do in IMSA's WeatherTech Sports Car Championship, you see a lot of things, you bring a lot of experience in, but how do you particularly or specifically go about handling strategies of yellows as they occur? And is there any kind of pre-race work or prep you can do to help you with yellow management in strategy calls?
Yeah, that was a great question, and not insignificant. I mean, a lot of people would think a yellow flag comes out, you slow down, maybe you make a pit stop, you go back out, you wait to go back to green. But the way IMSA's rules are, and what's cool about, I think, about sports car fans is that they get into the understanding of the rules. You know, we talked about drive times last week, and it's a complex thing, and yellows are the same, which doesn't make it super easy for the casual observer, but certainly for the dedicated sports car fans, it's a thing that really, really is an important part of it. So the basics with IMSA are yellow flag comes out, and they close the pits immediately. So you'll see a big yellow light at the pit entry,
yeah,
and that indicates the pits are closed. You cannot come in the pits when that happens. Then they will put the pace car out in front of the overall leader, almost always a prototype car, and everybody else comes back around and bunches up. And then what's unique about sports car racing, multi-class racing, is that they do what's called a pass around. And this can get confusing, but it's actually quite simple. What happens is when they put the pace car out in front of the overall leader, the prototype leader, everybody comes around, and it's fair. Let's say you were a prototype car almost about to be lapped, and the yellow came out. The pace car would come out in front of the overall leader, and you, as the almost lapped car, would get to make up that 7/8 of a lap and come back to the queue. So you would not lose a lap. But if you're in one of the other classes, you can actually get trapped behind the pace car and ahead of your class leader, and you don't get to make up that 7/8 of a lap. So it's unfair just by chance that happens to you. So what IMSA allows is what's called the pass around, which allows all cars ahead of their class leader but behind the pace car to pass the pace car and come back around. So everybody gets the same chance that the prototype cars do to come around and not get screwed up by that 7/8 of a lap that they're down.
Sure.
So that's the very first thing that happens on the very first lap. So when you see cars going up around the safety car, that's all that's happening. Nobody's getting an advantage. Nobody's getting gypped. And in fact, it's allowing it to be fair to the other three classes that are in the race. Then the next time by, IMSA allows the pits to be open for prototype and, well, for just prototypes. And the reason they split it, the first lap for prototypes only, the second lap for GT cars only, is because they split the pits. If you'll notice the way the pits are set up, they'll be, for the most part, a prototype car. Behind it will be a GT. Behind it will be another prototype. Behind it, GT. So it alternates like that to allow the most space for pitting cars. So open for prototypes, they should have good clear in. They can make their pit stop and come out. The next lap around, it's open for GT. They come in, they go out, and then that's the end of the actual pit stop sequence. Then we'll talk about the strategy in a second, but on the final lap, what they allow is for any cars between the pace car and the overall leader to go around past the pace car. And this is where some of the strategy comes in.
Yeah.
If you're a lap behind, you can actually make up a full lap. And it harkens back to the old days when NASCAR had their lucky dog and Grand Am had a name for it. I can't remember what their name was, but it's really to try to make the racing better so that a car that had some bad thing happen to it or whatever, you know, had a delayed pit stop or something, could get back in contention by getting a lap back. And so if you're a lap down, here's the strategy that everybody plays. You're a lap down, you stay out when your pits are open for your class. So let's take us, for example. We're a lap down with our Nissan prototype. Yellow flag comes out. We stay out when it's open for prototypes. All the prototypes come into the pits. We move up right behind the safety car because everybody else pitted. They all come out behind us. Now we're the first car behind the safety car. When they come to the lap right before the green, they'll call what's called the final wave by. And any car between the safety car and your class leader, just like the pass around, but any car there gets to go around. So we now get to go around to the back of the queue. We've unlapped ourselves. So we get our lap back. We're on the lead lap. We're at the very tail of the field, but at least we made our lap back. And usually it's coming to the green. So a lot of times if we need to pit, we pit on that lap when it's coming to green, and we're, you know, we lose another 20, 30 seconds. But at least we got our lap back. So it's a way that IMSA allows cars to recover from some problem, which is pretty cool.
And you also have a bit of a unique challenge with your Pro-Am driver lineup in a full Pro-Pro class like DPI. And that's not speaking ill of team owner John Bennett. John does an amazing job as someone who is not a professional race car driver. But knowing that he is not only the team owner, but just loves driving, there's also the fact that from a strategy standpoint, which we saw last year when you guys won a couple of races and almost won the entire championship in LMP2 with a Pro-Am dynamic, from the timing stand of choosing which driver you put in when and how you manage these yellows to try and make up some ground that might have been lost when you were not able to have a full pro lineup, you're having to do, you know, a little bit of time loss management to get yourself back in the game to go and hunt down some of those P2s or prototypes that might have eked out a bit of an advantage before the yellow. So you've got an added thing that honestly most of your competitors have not or do not need to concern themselves with.
Exactly. It's a challenge, but it's just another aspect of what goes into the strategy. You know, you talked about pre-race planning of strategy with yellows. It's exactly what we do. You know, we can kind of predict where we may be relative to the others. At the end of a fuel stint, we'll much like a football team, will have certain plays for certain situations that they've pre-planned. We have the same thing that we will do, whether we want to pit at certain times, depending on how far we are behind. We know exactly how close we have to be to the leader in order to pit, change drivers, add fuel, change tires, and get out and not get lapped. You know, we'll know we have to be within 22 seconds of the leader, and if we are, we can pit, change drivers, and we won't get lapped. We know exactly under yellow where the pace car has to be when we're at the pit entry so that we can get in, make our pit stop, and get out before the field comes around and we lose a lap. So when we're trying to do that final wave by and we're coming by, you know, trying to catch the pack, we know whether we can pit that lap and make it or whether we have to go another lap in order to catch the field and still make it. We have some no-go points on the track for that. Last year, some people might have noticed, we even, at Laguna, we even stopped on the racetrack before the pit entry, just stopped the car.
Yeah.
And we waited for about 25 seconds because we needed to reach, we talked about last week's minimum drive time, we needed to reach the minimum drive time for John. And it was better for us to stop on the track, wait for that time to burn, and then go into the pits, then do a whole nother lap and pit as we were coming to the green. So it's another play we've had in our playbook for 5 years, and the situation never arose to call it, but it's something that we've always had, we've always talked about. We just got to use it once there, and it was a strategy that's perfectly legal and something that just is unique to the way IMSA does their drive time and their yellows, and it all, you know, it all kind of plays together in the situation of what to do when. It's not super straightforward.
So I was at WeatherTech Raceway, Laguna Seca, a couple of days ago for the IndyCar test. And I won't name names, but I will mention that there was one team in particular there that made a decision that led me to recount the fact, and also some of the others who I spoke with recount the fact that that team's decision-making capabilities are so suspect, as proven throughout the years, that in the case of a yellow, and should we pit or should we stay out, that team is almost a beacon to all the other teams. Whatever they do, we're going to do the opposite, because we know that when presented with the chance to make the wrong call, they're guaranteed to go in the wrong direction, so we're just going to wait and see what they do, and then we're going to know, do the opposite, we'll be fine. Without naming teams, are there any of your competitors, or I shouldn't say competitors, are there any instances where you've seen either with competitors in a certain class over the year, or just general situations where you as a race strategist, as well as the race engineer, know that, all right, well, it looks like that team is putting out tires, or looks like, you know, these folks over here are getting ready to pit under yellow. Maybe we should either consider doing so because that team is known to be pretty darn sharp in this specific area of strategy, or others where you go, oops, if they're laying out tires, we're staying out. Just curious how much the looking over the fence aspect plays a role in things for yellow strategy.
Yeah, that's a great question, because it certainly does, especially in some certain circumstances. We just talked about getting your lap back and the fact that all the cars in your class ahead of you have to pit for you to be then moved up behind the safety car and in position to be allowed that final wave by to get your lap back. Well, one of the things we look at in our, we talked about last week, our race strategy programs that we have available to us. One of the things that that shows us is how many laps it's been since each car has pitted. So we can quickly look at the cars ahead of us, and we know what the fuel range is in laps of all the cars. It's all very, very close because of IMSA's BOP. So we know, we can look at it quickly and, okay, the three cars ahead of us are all within two laps of needing fuel anyway. They'll all pit for sure. So we'll stay out. They'll pit. We'll be in position to get our lap back. So we look at what the others do. But as you mentioned, some teams can get that strangely wrong. And it's happened to me before where I'm going, okay, these three cars, they all need to pit for sure. We'll stay out. We stay out, and one of them stays out. And then it goes green, and they pit on the first green lap. And I'm like, oh, they just blew it. And it cost us getting our lap back because another team blew their pit stop strategy. And so that's frustrating. Or it can go the other way. Daytona is a great example. We were one lap back. We needed to get that lap back at Daytona. The yellow came out. Penske had two cars. They pitted one. They were both had done the same number of laps. They pitted one and left the other one out to block us from getting our lap back. Because, you know, I'm supposing now, and maybe I'm just... maybe I'm just thinking that they're worried about us, but in any event, what they did by keeping their car out was prevent us from getting our lap back and getting back on the lead lap, which is a great strategy. I've done that before when I was at level five and we had two cars. We will purposely block our competitors from getting a lap back by staying out with one of our cars. And so it's a game where we're actively looking at what the others are doing, and not so much trying to copy them, but trying to come up with an advantage based on what we think they're, you know, what they're going to do or what we can see them doing.
You know, there's another topic here that we were asked to explore, and this is one of a few, we'll call them Jeff Brown rules, and we'll get into some of those other rules that you've either caused a sanctioning body to tweak or amend or otherwise implement because of you. And this, it does draw back to sports cars, but this initially was something that was caused by you, IndyCar rear view mirrors, a rule that you exploited in the 1990s. So again, I know this will wind its way back to sports cars, but let's crack this one open as our closing topic for this week, Jeff.
Sounds good. This is kind of a fun one. It's always a badge of honor to get a rule made because of what you've done. It happened in sports cars, but this one was the quick story is the IRL had just started, and it's when a new sanctioning body and new cars come along. There's always some rules that maybe you can exploit, not cheat, but exploit. So, as a lot of people know, at Indy, there's qualifying. There's a qualifying line, and they bring out the tech inspection area, the tech plate on the pit lane, and every car goes over that tech plate right before they go into the little alley to go out for qualifying. Well, we brought our car out there, and we're on the tech plate, and one of the officials says to me, you don't have any rearview mirrors on your car. And I said, nope. And they said, but you have to have rearview mirrors. And I said, nah, I don't think so. And so the rule books come out and pages get flipped, and they're like, oh, yeah, yours. You don't have to have rearview mirrors on your car. And I said, no, I'm pretty sure you don't. So we went out and qualified with no rearview mirrors on the car. And they were those little stock kind of mirrors back in those days, you know, not the fancy ones that we have now with the aerodynamically shaped ones. These are like these SPA little mirrors that just go through a bolt in the side of the tub.
Oh, yeah. I've had many. I hated them. They fell apart all the time, but yeah.
Right. So anyway, the next year, there's a rule that comes out in the next year's rule book that says you must have rearview mirrors on the car, affixed on the car at all times. And there's actually a dimension, like a minimum dimension of the rule, of the mirror. So I roll through tech the next year, and it's the same official again, and he goes, ha-ha, you don't have rearview mirrors on your car, and it's a rule this year. I said, no, I've got mirrors on my car. And he goes, yep, nope, where are they? They're not here. They're not on your car. I said, no, they're on my car. I said, look inside. And he looks inside the cockpit, and they're on the car, but instead of sticking outside the car, they stick inside the car, and they're folded up against the side of the car, above the driver's arms, basically, above his hands, inside the cockpit, folded up, you know, right across, on the inside of the tub. And he said, but you can't see through them. You can't see anything. And I said, rule doesn't say that. Rule says you must have rearview mirrors on the car, and they must be of this dimension, and they must be on the car at all times.
Doesn't say where on the car, just says on the car.
Just on the car. So we go out and qualify. So we go out and qualify that way. Next year, there's like a page and a half of rules. There must be on the car this size to afford a clear and visible, unobstructed view of the rear of the car at all times, cannot be adjusted while the car is in motion. Da, 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 da. I mean, there's a page and a half worth of mirror rules for the Indy cars, and they got me. I qualified with mirrors the next year, and that was the end of the story. But it was kind of a cool, kind of a fun thing. And it was good that the officials, you know, kind of took it as a fun game too. They didn't pull out the old spirit and intent. You know, well, the spirit of that rule is that you're supposed to be able to have them on the outside of the car, so you have to have them that way. They went, you got me. Okay, we'll get you next year.
But now, with the rearview mirrors that we have in sports car racing that are seemingly more advanced than probably the entire Indy Racing League chassis that you were engineering back in the day that do this and that and go in 47 directions, I am positive that you look at the rules as they come out every year in IMSA or whatever category you might be in sports car racing, and comb through them. So this is something I need you to admit to here, Jeff, that you don't just say, oh, well, they got me back in the day and in open wheel and, you know, all the rule books now have kind of been modified here, you know, for what you do to make sure there are no loopholes. But you can be honest, you look at the rules every year, even coming into 19, to see if someone might have slipped up or lacked the specifics that would keep you from taking them off the car for qualifying.
Well, yes, I will admit that. And there is a rule in IMSA, the current rule is that you must start the session qualifying for the race with the mirrors, with rearview mirrors on the car. What's interesting is that if they get knocked off during competition, you do not have to pit to replace the mirrors. You can actually run with no mirrors in IMSA. The caveat is that if there is any contact or incident or anything with your car while you're running without rearview mirrors, the big part of the blame is going to be automatically put on you, and responsibility for that incident is likely going to be your responsibility rather than the other car. But you don't have to stop and replace your mirrors, which is different from how it's been in the past. A couple of years ago, they made that rule. And so, yeah, I thought about how could we maybe knock those things off at the right time. But again, sports car racing, it's traffic is so big that you really, it's actually a big performance advantage. I've run mirrors bigger and in un-aerodynamically advantageous spots just to help us in traffic, because it's a huge advantage.
Well, the other thing too we need to realize is that the minute you come up with some sort of spring-loaded radio-controlled button you can push from pit lane that make the mirrors go boing and bounce off the car, by the time we get two or three races down the road, everyone else will have figured that out, and by the end of lap one, there will be a long caution as IMSA goes out and picks up, you know, 80 individual mirrors, because every other team will be hitting the spring-loaded button to make those suckers go flying off. But this is also, and again, I'll just wrap up with, this is something that I love about this sport, Jeff, because we know that drivers are always looking, how can they find that tenth of a second? Finding a tenth would be an amazing improvement. Can they do it through more fitness? Can they do it through better hand-eye coordination? They're training constantly. Then you also realize that to folks like yourself, as a race engineer, you are looking through the rule book trying to find similar advantages in things that don't just say, all right, we tell you this is how you can do something. Then your mind says, all right, let me figure out how to do it better than everyone else. Not every race engineer looks at a rule book and is thinking of what it doesn't contain. Not everyone thinks in the negative or in the absence of, okay, well, you said that we can do this. Well, but you didn't say it had to be that. And there's nothing else I can find that would bar me from doing that. So, and granted, then you have some rule books, which I think IndyCars today paints a fairly clear statement in saying anything we have not said you can explicitly do is prohibited. So it farms out the creativity a bit of anything that might have been left out. But that's ultimately a big part of your job, too, is realizing, okay, we are all working for the same rules, but what might I be able to find that others can't? It's a little bit of a treasure hunt every year.
Yeah, I mean, a treasure hunt, Marshall, is exactly what it is. Every year I go through that, I go through the rule book, and we have a list of what's changed, what's new, and it makes you think. Sometimes a rule can actually spark a thought. You know, they write a rule or they change a rule for a reason. And normally that reason is because somebody's tried to exploit it or brought it to their attention, or they've seen other teams do that. And there are sometimes when you go, oh, well, if they wrote a rule because of this, then other people must have been doing that. Therefore, I need to look at that too and see how I can do the same thing, or why would they do that, or what would be the reason for this rule. And it, you know, you can look at it more than just, I have to follow these rules, it can actually lead you, as you say, on your treasure hunt to some other areas to explore that you may not thought of.
I've mentioned this before. I think it's been a while, though, on maybe my Week in Sports Cars podcast, and it's just on this topic of, I remember it was in Champ Car, I believe, towards the latter final years of Champ Car, where they had a private or a secured online forum where teams and race engineers could ask questions of the series, possible rule clarifications or otherwise. And this one was regarding ballast, and someone from one of the most dominant teams sent in a request, which all their competitors were able to see as well, asking if, due to the high density of the metal, if Champ Car would approve their use of depleted uranium as ballast. Well, you know, that one's always easy to tell. It's the one glowing as it goes by. But yeah, again, right. It's those things where you go, well, the rules don't say you can't use depleted uranium, and you're like, oh my gosh. But that's part of your job. If you're not the guy coming up with ideas, hopefully most of them sane, you know, that's a big part of what you have to do, which, again, I know it's not the sexy part. It's not something where you're on TV and you're on the timing stand and being interviewed by whomever. This is the fun stuff where you just get to uncork your creative mind sitting in the office or wherever, trying to think how to beat the next person with the same rules.
Sometime I'll tell you, we'll talk about the story of the car I ran against that had four reservoirs, one at each corner of the car, with mercury and a mercury pump and a valve where the driver could pump mercury, liquid mercury, into whatever of the four containers he wanted to change the ballast dynamically during the race as tire wear and fuel burned. It's true.
If I haven't told you lately, it might have been since last week, but you're a treasure, Jeff Brown, and I appreciate the time that you take and also the effort that you put into this little Inside the Sports Car Paddock show of ours. So thank you again, my friend, and we'll look forward to capturing some more fun next week.
Can't wait to do it. I hope people send in some more ideas, and we'll talk about it. It's always fun talking with you, Marshall, and I'm glad people enjoy it.
On the phone from, well, Tokyo, I guess, is Jan Mardenborough after the announcement earlier this morning, UK time, of Nissan's plans for the 2019 Super GT Championship. Jan, just exactly where are you and what time is it there?
Tokyo, and it is 10 to 10 in the evening.
I guess it's been a very busy day today with the announcements from Nismo, from Nissan, about the Super GT and other programmes.
Yeah, it's been a long one. The announcements are always, there's a lot of things to do, a long time, lots of talking, lots of photos, lots of talking to fans. But it's nice to see all the drivers as well, and finally be able to talk about, just on social media, not getting told off by people posting things that you shouldn't post before the announcement. So now I'm free to do whatever I want in my life.
Good stuff. It's been a little while that you've known about your deal, but I guess it must have been frustrating not being able to confirm that some of the rumours that have been out there on the internet have been completely false.
Yeah, there's that. And also, you know, last week, for example, I was in the north of Japan in Hokkaido doing some ice driving training with the new drivers, and I can't post anything of that, even though it's really fun and I've got some really good footage, but I can't post it because they were like, well, if you post something, some fans are going to put something together and they'll be able to figure out who's there and whatnot. And yeah, so I can do whatever I want now.
But now we know you are back and part of the scene. How many years now in Japan in Super GT?
So this is going to be the fourth year in racing in Super GT and the third year in GT500.
And tell us a little bit about that scene. It's something that is getting an increasing European and US audience through the live streaming that's now done. It's it's very different, isn't it? Tell us a little bit about the scene. Tell us a little bit about what it's like from, if you like, your side of the spectator fence.
It's getting a lot more interest from foreign drivers. There's a lot more foreign drivers wanting to get into Super GT. I hope it translates to the fans and people viewing outside of Japan, because as a championship, it's run like amazing. It's my favorite championship because it's run so well. The amount of fans we get at the track can be 45, 50,000 people.
Wow.
Over a weekend, and every race is packed. Every grandstand is full. Every racetrack we go to, even round one at Okayama, where it's 5 degrees, it's packed. Even test sessions is packed. So, you know, the manufacturers, they're putting a lot into it, and there's a tire war going on, as well as development of engines throughout the season. We have development of aero parts, and it's, I hope, Nismo TV has helped a lot over the last few years doing the streaming live with commentary, with English commentary. That's helped a lot. I just hope there's even more people knowing of Super GT and to make the championship even larger. This year is going to help again with DTM getting involved with Super GT, and hopefully that will bring even more foreign influence and foreign fans and spectators into the sports, into Super GT, because it's you go to America and you talk to an American person who does IMSA and they have no idea of the championship, and this is I think is a bit of a tragedy. It needs to change, so hopefully we can do that quickly.
Well, let's think about that. I mean, with this the audience for this particular podcast, principally European, down under in Australia, New Zealand, and of course in the United States, North America. And it may be they're not as familiar as perhaps we all should be with the capabilities of the cars that you're going to be driving. I mean, comparing to a DPI and LMP1, and you've had experience racing in LMP1 and in LMP2. So just give us an idea of the numbers attached to the fabulous beast you're going to be campaigning this year.
Okay, so in terms of downforce levels, it's on the same level as, say, a non-factory LMP1, so like a Rebellion type, similar to that type. But in terms of tire grip, it's a lot more than I've experienced in any other category. I've never done LMP1 in a, say, like a rear-wheel drive car. Obviously, the LMP1 Nissan was front-wheel drive, and that had its issues, but compared to an LMP2, the tyre grip is a lot more because of the tyre war that's going on here in Super GT. Each track we go to, each test session we go to, is a specific compound and construction specific to that weekend. And in testing, we go testing to at Malaysia next week, and we'll be developing compounds for mid-season in the peak of Japanese summer, and constructions that we're going to try for round one in the first three races of the season. Just tire grip is just a lot higher. Mechanical grip is higher. Downforce levels, it's comparable to a LMP2, more than an LMP2, not quite Audi, Toyota spec downforce levels. Power-wise, they don't tell us the numbers because it's all a secret. But it's a, for people that don't know, it's a 2-litre turbocharged four-cylinder engine. The power feels like it's north of 650 horsepower, with huge anti-lag settings we have on the car. We've always got to keep that turbo spinning. They redline at 10,000 RPM, and all the power is within, you know, from probably about 8,000 to 10,000, that's it. It's just in that 2,000, barely 2,000 RPM power band. So keeping the turbo spooled up is a real challenge for the engineers, for the engine guys. In the races, we have pit stops. So we can do refueling. We can do, you know, tire changes. We can do no tire change if we don't want to. The weight of the car is 1,020 kilos. That's the minimum weight. We have success ballast, so over the last few years, however many points you score at each round, that's your next, at the next race, you're going to have double the weight. So if you score, if you, you know, have 20 points, you have 40 kilos of ballast. And that keeps the championship interesting. I mean, yeah. Other drivers have other opinions. For me, myself, I quite enjoy the success ballast. There is a game to be played with that. There's a game, there's a strategy you could do to finish fourth in every race and you'd still be able to probably win the championship or be there. But it's there's a lot more variables in it to be able to do that.
And of course, on top of all that, I mean, you know, that's a very old-fashioned 21st century sort of series, that you're one of very few drivers at international level then that is experiencing on a week-by-week basis the opportunity to develop a car in terms of aero, in terms of engine, and in terms of the tyres too. That's extremely unusual in world motorsport now.
Yeah, it's a definite positive. It's, you know, I've grown up in my career so far in spec series racing, GT3, Formula 3, GP3, and so on, and that is great, it's awesome, but when you talk to people who've raced in the, you know, the 80s and 90s, where there's a bit more, there's a lot more freedom in how you develop a car within the rules, and you hear some of the stories and some of the genius ideas that engineers have come up with in a category to get that edge, it's great. And Super GTs, yeah, well, outside of Formula 1, I don't know of another category. I mean, I don't know the complete rules of LMP1, but I suppose LMP1 does have that. They have different, you know, aero packages for each round, and they allow development. But anyway, we have tyre wars and tyre development. That's completely, you know, open. We can develop the engine throughout the season. Each year, the teams are allowed to develop a certain area of the car in terms of aero. So this year, for 2019, the teams are allowed to develop the flick box area, which is basically the front dive planes of the car. That's the only part that's allowed to be developed from 2018 to 2019. And it's great for the fans as well, people that are interested in the Super GT. You know, we have Autosport Japan in Japan, and you know, you read through the book, and I don't understand a word of it, but there's, you know, 20 pages of just detailed analysis on the GT500 cars, and it's great. It's the amount of attention to detail and the focus on Super GT in Japan is huge. And it's just that and Formula One they love, and of course World Endurance as well, but Super GT is their kind of their crown jewel.
Well, I mean, and then beyond that, of course, not just that development, but the fact you're up against two other big Japanese factory sets of teams as well, and they're all going through parallel developments. I mean, it is stupendous racing.
Yeah. The racing's great. You know, each round, the Japanese tracks in general tend to be a bit more old school. So for like UK viewers, and I don't know, I'm trying to think of a European track that's kind of like Alton Park, but the tracks are properly old school, kind of narrow. And then you have your Fujis and your Suzukas, which are just iconic. But in the races as well, we have GT3 cars, which they're called GT300 in Japan, but they're the same car. It's a GT3 car, and I think there's about 28 of those cars. So the grid is huge. We have, there's 400 or 500 cars from Nissan, you have six Lexuses, and then 5 Hondas. So 15 GT500s, and then another 28 or so GT3s. And
plenty of traffic.
Yeah, it's great. It's so much fun. You go to races like at Sugo, which is a really small track north of Tokyo. And, I mean, this circuit is, you wouldn't believe you can have a GT500 and GT3 race there. at the track. It's so narrow, can't really overtake anywhere. And but in the races, it's great because you know you can make your move in when you overtake the GT3s, and it's a mess. There's you know cars everywhere on lap six. You know the GT3s are having their own race, and then you have the 500s, which we're just trying to make our way through and have our own race as well. And the respect they have, all the drivers have, is great as well. It's unlike any other championship I've been in before. The amount of respect each driver has for each other is impressive.
There's a big change coming with Super GT, and for that matter, DTM, which is basically now almost a sister championship with the new Class 1 regulations, and we're expecting joint races pretty soon as well. Do you know yet if you're going to be involved in that?
I think the venue is going to be Fuji, maybe. I think it's Fuji, and then Hockenheim, but I don't know the ins and outs of it. I think it's still being completely nailed down, and every time I hear a rumor about it, it keeps changing.
But this is about potentially getting another global set of regulations in this case, with what I guess we'd call in the case of GT500s, which are GT prototypes, the same as the DTM cars, with common engine and aero regulations, which it's planned might see some of the German manufacturers come to Japan, might see some of the Japanese manufacturers come and play in Germany, and potentially might lead to something more international in the future.
Yeah, I think it's great that they're combining, and I mean it looks good, but I just hope for Super GT's sake they don't make it into a spec series.
Yeah,
there needs to be freedom. So what wouldn't be good, for example, is for all the suspension components, all the uprights and whatnot to be standardised. I think that would be bad, because you need to have, you know, some freedom. That's what makes Super GT great, and which is why DTM is attracted to Super GT. And I just hope they look at it and they look at what's great, what makes each category great, and what makes Super GT great, and they can make the right decisions. There needs to be freedom.
Now, you've been involved with USA going through before in your earlier iterations of GT racing. We'll come and talk about LMP racing in a moment, but also single-seater racing. Explain to us, because it's clearly, at least in no small part, your ability to work with engineers and to develop a car, the interest that's been shown by Nissan for you in a role with Formula E as well. What's that all about, Jan?
So the Formula E gig, I'm the Nissan EDAM simulator driver, and in Formula E, the simulator is the most important part. I'm not bigging myself up, but it's used in so much in developing the car, to understand the software systems they have on the car, to calculate battery mileage, to calculate the how efficient the car is in the race, setup changes, software changes. You know, on a simulator, a battery motor can be simulated much more accurately than a conventional combustion engine, because you have, you know, in battery power, your torque is instant, so your power can be accurately modeled, and the way that the power comes in can be modeled much more accurately than a combustion engine. In Formula E also, it's you know, everyone knows it's battery powered, so there's one car this year, the car has to last the whole race, instead of last year where they had each in a team they would have two cars, but over a weekend they would come in for a pit stop and change to another car with a fresh battery, and then you'd complete the race. Whereas this year, it's with the Gen 2 car in Season 5, it's just one car. So the car has to last 45 minutes plus one lap. And it's a long way, you know. 45 minutes is a long time in a single-seater race. And For endurance, it's nothing, but for a battery to last that long, you know, racing hard, it's impressive. So, you know, my role and the team's role is to make the battery last as long as possible while giving the most amount of performance. So in the race, you start with a full battery at the start of the race, and you know, your battery is full, so you can't have regen. You can't regenerate more energy back into the battery. So that in itself needs to be modeled in a simulator, because that changes the brake bias. So at the start of the race, your brake bias isn't optimum at all. It's too forward, because you're having no regen on the rear to recharge the battery. But after 7 or 8 laps, when the battery depletes enough for you to be able to regen, use the regen and to recharge the battery a little bit, you're able to do that, and you can model that in the simulator. So my role is, and the team's role is, to make the car as normal to drive as possible, because there's a lot going on that isn't normal in a Formula E car. There's a lot of settings you've got to change in the car, so to make it as smooth as possible and as easy as possible, that's my role, and to make the car quicker.
Now, I don't want to go kind of down the road that I'm sure just about every interviewer does with you, but it does strike me that that's at a completely different degree is very much Back to the Future. For those that are listening to this and don't know Jan's entry into international motorsport, Jan, one of the success stories that came through the Nissan GT Academy as a gamer and into motorsport, now very much a professional race driver rather than gamer. But how much of that early part of your development, Jan, is transferable into what is a very different sort of, well, I don't want to call it a computer game, that's insulting, but you get the point, a simulation.
It can be transferred. Just being able to drive a simulator, there are drivers that drive in real life that can't use simulators, because you don't have the sensation of the car moving around underneath you, and some people just can't get along with simulators, some drivers. I've never had that problem. I've started off on playing games at home and on simulators with steering wheels and whatnot, so I know what it's like to be sat in a, you know, in a dark room for many hours just going round and round and giving feedback. It's just what I've done and what I'm used to. And with the experience of real life racing and working with engineers in real life as a professional, you're able to then translate your feelings and your opinions a lot better than I would have in the past. For example, I know how to use a simulator. If I jumped on a simulator at the same time I was a gamer as a gamer and then jumped on the Formula E sim, I could probably do the same thing, but I wouldn't know how to give correct feedback to the engineer. So they kind of both work, both the experience that I've had in my life help each other for this role in Formula E, with being quick and then giving correct feedback.
Any chance in the future for a race seat for you there?
Maybe. I'm in the right place. I did a rookie test not too long ago at Marrakesh, which went really well. I'm in the right place, I guess. I mean, at the moment with GT500, that's my goal, and I'm currently racing a car which my 8-year-old self would love me for. I want to race cars which, as an 8-year-old, go, wow, that's, you know,
fantastic. That's cool. So I guess on the to-do list is to break through and win that elusive first GT500 race, and of course then be part of an attack for the championship. But what else in the next year or two? What else is on your, what's high in your to-do list?
Le Mans. 100%, yeah. Go back there. I need to race there again, man. It's been too long. I need to do that race again. It's the best race weekend ever. And it's painful every time you go back to Le Mans, because dams, which run the Nissan E-Dams Formula E car, is that they're based at Le Mans, so You're right there. Last time I was there was in January, early January, to do some sim. And, I mean, it's weird going back to Le Mans.
I'm not racing.
And seeing no teams, it's really strange. And their workshop is very near the track, so you have to actually drive on the mobile sand to get to the track. And oh, man, this sucks. It sucks. Well, I need to be back in June.
Well, for those that didn't follow Jan's career earlier on, when LMP2 was very much a thing for the Nissan factory drivers, the times, I think, I don't want to embarrass you, were spellbinding. Are you still in contact with a couple of teams? Is there a chance we might see you back there in the next couple of years?
Well, hopefully my manager is, Darren. He's trying to work his magic. I need to be back there. Yeah, it's such a cool event.
Well, such look, a cool race. Look, if you're listening in, team managers, to this one, and you fancy just reacquainting yourselves with the silky smooth skills of Jan Mardenborough, you know where to look. At Jan the Man on Twitter, and that's I am Darren Cox for Jan's manager, Darren Cox. Jan, the very best of luck with what looks to be a fantastic season to come in Super GT.
Brian Herta was really happy to see the competitiveness of your new Hyundai Veloster TCR cars on their debut at Daytona late last month. Was also maybe even happier to see, as a brand new first-time entrant in IMSA, that the Brian Herta Autosport program was also a very strong one. I know the final results in the Michelin Pilot Challenge race weren't everything that you asked for, but I thought it might be interesting just to catch up and get your thoughts on, you know, you've been in World Challenge, obviously you've been in IndyCar for a while, you've been in Global Rallycross, Indy Lights. Tell us about this new experience as an IMSA team owner.
Well, thanks, Marshall. It wasn't the dream, you know, roll off the truck with brand new cars and go wax the field, but I wasn't expecting it would go that easy either. You know, we're really pleased to finally get this Veloster and TCR car here, and you know, we kind of had a really accelerated schedule. We only just received the cars less than 2 weeks prior to the race, so you know, a lot of work went into getting the cars ready, getting them to the track. We're able to make the race, successfully debut. The finish, like you said, wasn't maybe what we'd hoped for, but you know, we had one car running second when it was involved in an accident not of its making, and the other car was running well and had a punctured radiator late in the race. So those things aside, you know, I think have to be really pleased that, you know, we've kind of made it there. And luckily we have a 6 week break now between Daytona and Sebring to really get our feet underneath us, do some testing with the car, do a little more work, and hopefully show up to Sebring prepared and ready to do battle.
So you had a very impressive season last year in World Challenge and TCR. Obviously a great fight there with the real-time Honda folks and other entrants. What are your thoughts on the quality of competition you have now in IMSA for the first time in TCR with the Hyundais? Obviously you've got a very talented guy in Ryan Eversley in the Hart Honda there. I mean, there's a number of strong entries. Give us some thoughts about the caliber of competition you're going up against.
I think, as expected, you know, the level is very high. Like you said, Some of the guys like Ryan Eversley, we did race against last year, and we know how good they are. A lot of the teams are maybe newer to us and some of the drivers, but very experienced in IMSA and in that discipline. But you're really happy to see, you know, multiple manufacturers, four manufacturers, 14 cars. TCR seems to be growing and gaining popularity, and so, you know, we're happy to be part of that and to see the whole class overall growing and thriving.
Of the couple of things that I find uniquely interesting about your program, Brian, one is the fact that while Hyundai does have a, call it a competition arm, and you know, obviously these chassis are being produced, their motors being made as good as they can be, I wouldn't describe it like what Honda has with Honda Performance Development or, you know, some of these other big, big houses that are massive and one-stop shopping. I know your team is looking after sales, parts distribution and supply here in the U.S. with these cars on behalf of Hyundai. How does this relationship work for you, knowing that it sounds like it's a little bit more than just a independent team? It sounds like you're also being asked to try and fill in a little bit of infrastructure for them as well.
Yes, here in the U.S., you know, people are very familiar with HPD and some of the U.S.-based groups like that. Where Hyundai is actually based, their racing motorsports base is in Germany, and that is where they run their WRC program out of. They build customer cars for R5, the customer i30N cars that we raced last year, yeah. And they built the Veloster and TCR car. So it's actually quite a large factoring operation, you know, on scale and size is bigger than the others. Where what's probably unique or sets us a little bit aside is we work directly through them as the U.S. representative. So in addition to racing the cars, we're the U.S. sales representative, and we're here to provide sales and technical support to U.S. customers so that, you know, we kind of help bridge that gulf so they're not dealing with, you know, delays, international shipping, time changes, difficulties in getting technical support or parts quickly. We're here on the ground stocking parts. We have on-site technical support, and so we're kind of think of us as an arm extending out from HMSG in Germany.
And how do you manage this from a, I guess, a structural or presentation standpoint? Because we know that, like in IMSA's WeatherTech Championship in the GT Daytona category, straight up 100% factory funded everything. Full factory efforts are not allowed there, but there are obviously a lot of great relationships and I guess you could say semi-works or partnerships between teams and manufacturers. How does this work for you in the Michelin series, knowing that, again, Hyundai is obviously a great partner of yours, but also, you know, there's a, call it a pro-am or a bit of an independent mindedness that also has to be maintained.
That's right. We have to kind of maintain that balance, and I think sometimes, you know, perception gets the better of us in that regard, because we do enjoy a good relationship with Hyundai, and that's important, but we don't view ourselves as a customer, as a factory program. We view ourselves as a customer program. We purchase our cars from HMSG in Germany, essentially as any other team would. And I think what you're seeing is Hyundai's really strongly supporting the class and the series. They've offered a very strong contingency program that offers, you know, $7,500 for a win in either the Blockplane GT Championship or in the Michelin Pilot Challenge Series. So there's strong support from Hyundai for anybody who's out racing the cars. They're activating at the races. They're bringing guests to the races. They're bringing dealers to the races. And that's a good thing. We haven't seen a strong Hyundai Motorsports presence in the past, and they're starting to really do that, and I think that's good news.
Let's talk a little bit about your driver lineup, Ryan. Obviously, you have great familiarity with the majority of those who are driving for you. Mark Wilkins, who sweetheart of a person, but also someone definitely underrated talent-wise, in my opinion, for far too long. You've got the happiest puppy in the paddock in Michael Lewis as his teammate. I love that kid. You know, he has a great future in public relations if he wants it, because, you know, I know the ship is currently sinking, but isn't the water beautiful? The kid's phenomenal. Then in the sister entry, you've got young Harry Gottsacker, who I'd love to hear some thoughts about him, because this is a pretty big step up for him. And then also Mason Filippi, who we saw last year some as well. Tell me about this young lineup, man, because it seems like, other than Mark, who, you know, bit of a veteran, you've got a lot of young talent being groomed here as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, when we when we went looking for drivers, obviously, you know, Mark and Michael were a no-brainer. We had a lot of success with them last year. As you said, they're great to have in the team. They provide a lot of great feedback and input on the cars. They push us to be stronger. But with this Veloster N, you know, this is a car that's aimed at a youth market. It was important to Hyundai that we represent that. So having, you know, some of the most exciting young talents and guys like Harry Gottsacker, who a lot of people aren't yet familiar with, and he's done some GT level racing, but he's still a young budding career. I think he's 19 years old. And Mason Felipe, who's just a little bit older than that, and did TCR last year for another manufacturer. We raced against him, and we're lucky to have him in the fold as well. We're very proud and excited about our lineup. I think it's almost maybe a little intimidating, or we've gotten some feedback from some of the other competitors, but you know, we're proud to have these guys. They're young, fast, talented drivers, but they have the right image. They're representing the brand, and they're representing the Veloster N to the right audience for Hyundai.
So with Brian Herta Autosport now in IMSA, idiots like me naturally hit the fast forward button for you and say, oh yeah, so let's talk about your DPI team you're going to have in 2 or 3 years, and when's the new Hyundai this and that coming out, and you must have all of these things ironed out. A lot of that's tongue in cheek, but do you allow yourself at this stage, Brian, with all of one IMSA race as an entrant under your belt, to try and look and plan that far ahead as to where you might take the team into the WeatherTech Championship and whatnot next year, the year after, who knows? Or do you try and keep your focus narrow until you get some more miles under your belt in its equivalent to the Indy Lights series?
Well, it's important that we stay focused on what we're doing right now, that's for sure. Right, if we don't execute, if we don't deliver, then there isn't any opportunity to do anything else. But if we can do those things, you know, Hyundai is a big brand. They have expressed interest publicly in other things. We certainly aspire to do other things. And the IMSA paddock in general being now in there, I think we're positioned to be able to do bigger other things in the future. But there's probably more speculation than truth to anything that's been out there so far. But certainly, you know, for us right now, what's important is to run a strong program and to win races. And if we keep doing that, then we've made the case that we can make for ourselves.
That's the last question for you. Very, very important one. So you were the architect who helped open the door for your son Colton to learn at the BMW Team RLL program. Obviously, you having driven for Bobby Rahal in IndyCar last year, said, hey, you know, while Colton's learning, you know, in Indy Lights, wouldn't be a bad thing for him to just get some additional seasoning being around, you know, veteran sports car drivers in this BMW program or whatnot. That's turned out well. He was a part of the GTLM winning team here at Daytona. Important question, do you get that Rolex like half the time? Do you get to wear that half the time? Because he wouldn't be wearing it if it weren't for you, man.
Well, I got to look at it. How's that? and because we were already there at Daytona running with the Veloster and TCR car, you know, I stuck around and was able to watch his race and enjoy the whole 24 hours as a fan, which was great. But you know, it's funny how that came about. I really wasn't much of an architect in that. BMW in Germany actually called us out of the blue and said, hey, we're looking for a young American. We think Colton's interesting, and would he be willing to sign up for a junior program? And that really entailed mostly going to races and watching other guys drive race cars.
Which young hard. Drivers love.
Right, which is hard to do. It's long. You got to wake up early and go to all the meetings, but you don't get to do the fun part. But they did put him in various cars throughout the year, and tested and evaluated him, and you know, he did well enough that I'm grateful to them because they really took a chance, right? He, he'd never done a GT race. Daytona 24 was his first GT race, and he was in a factory BMW car and ended up winning the race, which is kind of a fairy tale crazy thing, but also, you know, really shows, I guess, that BMW's commitment to their junior program, and they promoted him from within. And, you know, hopefully he's going to be back in the car at Sebring, and hopefully they can continue on the path they've been on.
Well, and I was going to say, in addition to my asinine, silly question, having seen your son win many things, obviously he's a very bright career moving up to IndyCar now, but I'm guessing being able to see your son stand on the freaking podium as a winner at the 24 Hours of Daytona, that probably has to stand out, I'm guessing, among the more prideful moments for you as a dad.
Oh, yeah. You know, just big smile. I had a lot of fun watching him compete and continue to develop. And, you know, to have that kind of success, I think that's just a cherry on top of the sundae. You know, for him, he was just, you know, happy to be there, happy to be part of that program, and then, you know, to actually win the race, even better.
Geez, and I'm just now thinking about this. I don't know why it's taking me so long. Were you able to find Victory Tacos in Daytona Beach? I don't even know if they're sold there.
We did when we got home. We flew home that night after the race. We got home very late.
Okay.
And we did go for tacos after back in California after.
All right. Family tradition's been maintained. Very, very important stuff.
Victory Tacos key.
Well, so happy we have you now, brother, in IMSA, and, you know, for me, and I hope others, it's a blessing that we have you there. We have you in IndyCar with your co-entry with Marco Andretti, Michael Andretti, and also the Kurb Agajanian folks. So happy for you, brother, to see this expansion working out well, and look forward to being able to talk more sports cars with you this year.
Awesome. Sounds good. Thanks, Marshall.
I was just curious, realizing that there might be many sports car fans today who've maybe heard mention that there was special performances at Brands in 1970, if you might be able to just share some thoughts about the day, the rain, and the challenge of making Porsche 917s go fast while staying on terra firma.
My memory is that I had a fairly substantial accident. I was helped into it by Chris Amon in the factory Ferrari.
Very kind of him. Very, very kind of him to provide.
I was actually lying in the second place, and Chris gave me just a touch, a little nudge, but it was all it took to send me flying off into the scenery. And I'd complained at Porsche, particularly to engineer Helmut Bott, throughout the year about the strength of the 917 chassis, because it was a very old-fashioned design. As you know, the 917 was built in a big rush to fulfill when the CIS changed the rules for 5-litre cars from a required minimum of 50 to 25.
Yes.
That was when Porsche immediately, I think they knew about it because they were doing it before the rule came out, but anyway, that was because, I think, Kuschke von Hanstein was on the CIS committee.
Mm.
So, you know, Porsche built these cars all under the direction of Ferdinand Piëch, who was an absolute firebrand and, of course, was the race director of racing at that time. And he took an enormous risk, business risk, in ordering the building of 25... 5-litre. In fact, they were 4.5-litre because the pistons and all of the engine running gear was out of the 908. But the chassis, you know, an aluminum space frame chassis at that time, when it was built in 1969, was very old-fashioned because Ford and Lola and other manufacturers were building monocoques.
Yes.
Or at least semi-monocoques, like the Ferrari, which were much stronger. And, you know, I didn't like the fact that if you hit something hard enough in a 917, it broke in half.
I was going to say, you know, it was made from coat hangers and aluminum foil, possibly. Yes.
So anyway, after I'd finished hitting everything in sight and revolving around, the tail came up over the top of the car and I couldn't get out, and so anyway And after, you know, I'd been complaining all year to Hairbot about the strength of the chassis. So I walked back to the pits, trudging through the mud and the rain, and I arrived at the Porsche pit covered in mud, and Hairbot said, "How are you, Brian?" I said, "I'm fine, thank you, Hairbot." And he then raised his finger and said to me, "Brian, now you see that the 917 is a very good car to have a crash in."
I'm hoping you invited him to have a crash of his own to compare sensations. Good Lord.
Yeah, so that was a not a very, it was memorable, but not a very good race to France Hatch 1970.
No. And I guess the last thing that might be interesting to impart on those who are learning about this, today's cars we see some have immense power, immense grip, a certain overabundance of downforce, which would allow incredible performances in the rain by even journeymen. Very much a different case in 1970. Beautiful shape on the 917, but certainly not a vehicle that was using much more than mechanical grip to keep it in place. Can you just share some thoughts about that with, and also tire technology being very different, where it just sounds like the most fearful thing one could do is drive a 917 in the driving rain around Brands.
Well, yeah, as mentioned earlier, when the 917 was built in such a rush in 1969, well, they really being built in late 68, 69, early in 69, of course, at that time, because Porsche were making the first ever attempt on the World Manufacturers Championship, because of the change in the rules to 3 liter for prototypes, they had a massive team, 10 drivers, 6 Germans, 3 English, Elford, Atwood and myself, and 1 Swiss, Joe Siffert. So I was a bit surprised in about March of 69 when I got a call from Porsche saying, "Herr Edden, you will come to Weissach and test the new 917. And I thought, you know, why do they want me when I'm living in England and they've got 6 German heroes ready to die for their fatherland close to Stuttgart? So I said, I just need to make some business arrangements. I'll call you back in 30 minutes. "Yeah, Herr Edmund, please be sure to call." So I called Joe Siffert in Switzerland, my co-driver, and I said, "Seppi, have you tested the new 917 yet?" And he's long silence, and then he says, "No, no, Björn," he said, "we let the others find out what breaks first." So unfortunately, I couldn't go. And then, of course, the first private owner to buy a 917, John Wolfe, the English driver.
Yes.
I had started his co-driver at Le Mans in 69, Digby Martland, in racing. He was from the north of England, from Southport, and he'd seen me in a sprint in a Mini Cooper. And he said, "You know, can you do one for me like that?" And so I'd got him racing. And so he spun in a straight line in practice, going over the Mulsanne hump. So he spun all the way down to the Mulsanne corner without hitting anything.
Very impressive.
Drove it back to the pit, got out, said to John Wolfe, "Thank you very much, John, and I have now retired." The 3 English drivers, Alfred Atwood and myself, we all tried to persuade John not to start the car. We said, "Let Herbert Linge start it. You know, he was the factory test driver." "No, no, it's my car and I'm starting," he said. Because he was killed on the first lap when he lost control at the White House corner. So the whole aerodynamic thing, I think, you know, that the emphasis for Porsche at that time was on straight-line speed. There was a huge emphasis on that for Le Mans. There was no chicanes and 4 miles in a straight line pretty well. And so I think the engineers in 69 knew what the problem was, that there was no downforce. But they couldn't do anything about it. They weren't allowed to do anything that would cost even 1 kilometer of top speed. And so it was only when John Wire was taking over the official running of the Porsche team for 1970 that the test was done at the Österreichring in about September of 1969 with John Horseman, the chief engineer for John Wire, and a couple of mechanics, Mano Kugi, the famous mechanic, and Peter Davis, and John Horseman, and no John Wire. And I don't even, I'm not sure whether David York was there or not, the team manager, but anyway, the test was, I was the sort of the John Wire representative, although for 1970, with John Wire, I was being paid by Porsche. It's a very complex situation. And Kurt Ahrens was there. And we ground round and round all day, changing this. We'd do one lap or two laps at a time, no difference. Whatever we did, it didn't make any difference. And at the end of the day, John Horseman said, "Brian, you see all these little gnats, little flies on the front of the car? There aren't any more anywhere on the car." And he said, "There's no downforce on the back." And so they borrowed, this was a Porsche test, so they borrowed aluminum, fiber, you know, not fiberglass, but duct tape and rivets and all sorts from the Porsche truck, which was there. And Emano Kugi and Peter Davis worked on it most of the night. And I came back the next morning and it looked like a pickup truck. And I was the first out, and I went round and round, seven or eight laps, and came in and then said to them, now we have a racing car. I was more than 4 seconds faster, you know.
Good Lord.
It was unbelievable. It was. That's what led to the short tail.
I love the fact that, again, this is an era where such an idea could be born out overnight, where the desire to make a change, you could come back in the morning and find that. So that's just phenomenal.
An unbelievable, really. So that's what led to the fables of 917.
And that was episode 3 of Inside the Sports Car Paddock, brought to you by Cooper Tires and the Justice Brothers. Hopefully you enjoy it. We're going to keep doing this Jeff Brown weekly explain something type routine. I love the guy. As you might have heard me mention in one of the earlier episodes, we've known each other for 28 years now. He was our race engineer, the Pfeiffer Ridge Racing Toyota Atlantic team, when I was a mechanic there, and just fell in love with the guy. So much fun, so good at what he does, so excellent at explaining things, and he and his wife are also excellent at producing talented kids. He's got one who is winning awards in Hollywood, and the other one who is winning races and being a general badass as a driver. So anyways, lots of fun with Jeff. And the other thing that I love about this new show, and I know that Graham is enjoying as well, I have no idea who our guest will be in the next episode. And we'll just see what comes to mind. Sometimes it might be a recommendation from y'all to reach out to someone. And it's just a little bit of a who knows. Who knows what we're going to get each week. And that's just, frankly, a nice break from some of the routine things that we do. All right. Well, I'm Marshall Pruitt. I got nothing else for you. I got to get back to work. This has been Inside the Sports Car Paddock, presented by Cooper Tires and the Justice Brothers, and thank you for listening.